Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Convention in Washington, D.C., deep in the belly of the beast here. It's amazing. We had a series of conservative guests on yesterday, pretty much one after another for 3 hours. So today we'll take a break and move back into the world of sanity in our first hour. It's our, as always, every first hour of every Friday, noon Eastern time, 9 a.m. Pacific time, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders, the one of two independents, used to be the only independent in the House of Representatives, now independent senator from Vermont in the United States Senate. And I think of Bernie, neither a Republican nor a Democrat, as America's senator. Yeah, Bernie will be taking your calls after we have a brief conversation. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, it's tomhartman.com. However you spell it should get you there, and you can just click live chat and drop in. Good morning, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. It's nice to hear a sane voice.
Don't talk too loud there, then.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we should put this on the speakerphone there. Let them hear some different.
Well, it's you know the word has traveled. So I'm on the radio row here, and the word has traveled that the guy from Air America is here, and some of the looks have been priceless. The thing that's amazing to me about this place, Bernie, is just off subject, but just for a second, is that. All of the women that I see, and there's a lot of them, are under 30 and incredibly attractive and wearing probably $500 to $1,000 worth of clothing each. And the vast majority of the men are young and well-scrubbed. When I go to, like, the Take Back America conference, you know, progressive conferences, you see a cross-section of America. You see people wearing suits. You see people wearing jeans. You see old people. You see young people. This reminds me of the trade shows that I used to do back in the business days when they used to just get professional models to do everything. I mean, it's even running the Mitt Romney gauntlet out here and the Sam Brownback gauntlet. It's all attractive young people. Period. It's almost like the conservative world is a staged presentation of something.
Well, in many ways it is. I mean, I think one of the aspects of corporate control over the media is that the media has given us a presentation of reality over and over again, which dominates the airwaves, both in terms of news and culture, which really ends up reflecting the interest of very, very few. I'll tell you a funny story, Tom. Just the other day, there was a joint meeting of the House and Senate Veterans Committee, and the guest speaker was the commander of the VFW, and there were probably between 500 and 1,000 VFW people from all over the country. These guys are not generally known to be the most progressive people in America. But when you got up and you talked to these guys about the absurdity of giving tax breaks to billionaires at the same time as we inadequately fund the needs of our veterans, you know what? You got standing ovations.
Yeah.
Standing ovations. These are just ordinary, middle-class, working-class Americans who understand that the priorities facing this nation are backwards. And unfortunately, the media, which is owned by fewer and fewer large media conglomerates, does not reflect that reality. And that's what these guys do. The right wing there, your friends along that media row, are selling a product that is owned by a few people. They develop this product and they try to convince the American people of that reality. But I think the good news is, Tom, that fewer and fewer Americans are buying that.
Yeah, no, and our voice is getting out. I had a guy come by here just a few minutes ago. I mean, they're conservatives from all these different exhibitors are pitching their wares, and he came by and he said, oh, that liberal Washington Post, they're doing this story about the VA. There's nothing wrong with the VA. Everything's just fine over there. I'll come on your show and I'll tell people the real truth. And I said, no, thanks, but no thanks.
No, there's a lot wrong with the VA. And even, I mean, no, we don't have to get to the disgraceful way in which the outpatient process in Walter Reed is now being run. I was there. I just went there the other day. And what you're seeing is kind of like a cheap hotel. Is what you're seeing, a cheap hotel where people are trying to get their lives back together after surgery, after intensive care, which is usually pretty good, inpatient, by the way. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of good staff at Walter Reed, does a very good job, but then they send them across the street to a cheap hotel, if you like, very depressing. Why? Why can't we house these guys in good accommodations, make sure they don't have to go through bureaucracy to get the help that they need, the medical appointments that they need, and so forth and so on? So on and on it goes, but it's not just the way we treat our veterans. It's the fact that we continue to have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. We have a president who in his recent budget has said, I want to provide hundreds of billions of dollars tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, but we cannot deal with special education for our schools. We cannot improve the quality of education. We can't make it easier for the middle class to send their kids to college. We can't deal with health care. In fact, we're going to have to cut back on Medicaid and Medicare. A president who barely understands what global warming, the significance of global warming is about. But I think that the American people are beginning to see through this big time and understand that we need to fundamentally change the priorities in our nation.
Yeah, amen. And it couldn't come faster. I mean, they have been so successful in so many ways since the Reagan's, you know, first kicked off the war on the American middle class in 1981. So successful at rolling back, you know, labor protections and consumer protection, and just, I mean, right across the board. And
there's been a war. There's no question about it. They have looked at A to Z. What do we have to do? And the answer is that they want to obviously privatize all of the social benefits that millions of people have struggled for, whether it is Social Security, whether it's Medicaid, cutting back on Medicaid, whether it is public education, whether it is environmental protection. The rights that people have struggled for to improve the quality of life for the middle class and working families, for our whole society, these guys want to dismantle. And our job is to do the exact opposite, is to bring people together to fight for a nation which works well for everybody and not just the very wealthy and powerful who are represented by that row of right-wing talk show hosts.
Yeah. We had a fellow on yesterday also that I was talking with saying there's no such thing as global warming. I mean, they're still trying to pitch that even.
I was just at a committee hearing yesterday, and, you have these guys, well, there are differences of opinion. Well, actually, among the scientific community, there are no more differences of opinion. Virtually all of the scientists who study the problem say global warming is real. It is very, very dangerous. We're seeing problems today, and we're going to see much more serious problems in years to come in terms of drought, in terms of flooding, in terms of the loss of coastlines, in terms of glaciers melting, people not being able to get the drinking water they need, people not being able to have land to farm, which will cause huge political problems. You know, drought, hunger, what do you think is what that means in terms of conflict all over the world, increase in human disease?
Yeah, we've already seen it, actually.
Yeah, we're beginning to see it, absolutely. But these guys, you know, the vice president and a few others remain some of the few people on the planet.
The old oil guys.
Pardon me? And
the old oil guys.
Yeah, and they're pushing it. But I think there is now a sea change among the American people. I know in my state of Vermont, people are very cognizant of it. And we are working. I was just at another meeting a few days ago with, I don't know if you're familiar with, it's called the Apollo Project.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's a wonderful project, and the idea is 100% right. Yeah. We're bringing together environmentalists, we're bringing together trade unionists, working people who are saying, look, A, we've got to address this horrendous crisis in global warming, and B, we can do it in a way that creates millions of good-paying jobs as we break our dependency on fossil fuel, as we move toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And there's just huge potential. We're beginning to see it in some degree, just the very beginning,
yeah,
with biofuels in the use. Farmers now were often hard-pressed, beginning to get some income.
Yeah.
By growing.
The in Oregon, for example, the big news in the paper today was that a dead factory in a depressed part of the state is being turned into the nation's largest solar panel factory. That's
unbelievable. That is fantastic.
Yeah. Now, the bad news is that the company that's doing it is a German company, because our trade deficit has been so bad, all these foreign companies are coming over and buying up America. So,
well, also, in terms of solar, we've lost. I believe in the United States, we saw the growth of that technology years ago.
Yeah, we developed it, I mean, to a large extent. But now it's, you know, German companies and Japanese companies who are leading the way, and they're even, you know. But, you know, at least it's happening. It's a good start. Finally, we just have a few seconds. The Employee Free Choice Act is moving through Congress. Bush has said he's going to veto it.
Of course, Bush will veto it because it gives workers the right to collectively bargain. What's been going on now is we have a National Labor Relations Board under Bush, which is very strongly pro-employer, anti-worker. It is increasingly difficult for workers to come together and form a union. I introduced legislation like this a very long time ago. I'm glad to see that it's moving now. We're going to have a very difficult time in the Senate getting closure on this because, obviously, Republicans don't want workers to collectively negotiate and get
good. But it's a start.
It's a good start, yeah.
It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. He'll be taking your calls right after this. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. Tom Harbin here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, Air America Radio. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Every Friday, our first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Sally in Detroit, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. Senator Sanders, I wonder if you could address, please, how urgent it is that the Congress get on the, just follow this system that's been set up now with the Washington Post talking about Walter Reed and all of the travesty that's going on there, and then Bob Woodruff coming out on the heels of his book.
Yes, Sally, thank you very much for raising that issue. And in fact, I just visited Walter Reed the other day to meet with a Vermont family that's there. Here's the bottom line on that. Overall, since Bush has been president, his budgets have been a disaster for veterans in general. He has thrown hundreds of thousands of what we call Category 8 veterans off of VA health care. There are waiting lists all over this country for veterans to get into the VA. And on top of that, with 22,000 veterans wounded in Iraq, many of them seriously and many more going to coming back, with PTSD or traumatic brain injury, we have a very, very serious problem. So what I wanted to mention to Sally, I'm a member of the Veterans Committee, and we are working very hard to substantially increase funding for veterans in general. Now, in terms of Walter Reed, which is not a VA facility, that's run by the DOD, this is what you got there, in my view. You got a facility where inpatient care is, in fact, very good. They do a very good job in some cutting-edge work in terms of amputees, in terms of occupational therapy, in terms of psychological counseling for some really tragic situations. It's a very depressing place to go to. The problem, which the Washington Post focused on, is, in fact, a national disgrace. And that is when these patients, when these young men and women leave the inpatient care and go to outpatient, some of them are housed in just very deplorable conditions. And I visited that so-called Building 18. And what it reminds me of is just there's a cheap hotel where you have two beds in a room, very minimal furniture, the heating in some cases right next to the bed. It's like a cheap hotel. And if you're trying to get your life back together again, having lost one or two limbs or an arm, or you're suffering confusion from brain injury, man, that is not the place you want to be in. The bureaucracy is you often within the military very difficult. You got to figure out when your next medical appointment is. You got to go across the street with a whole lot of traffic. Very bad situation. And we are on board legislation to make real improvements in outpatient care there.
Thank you. Jeremy in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, my question was, if Bush were to attack Iran, I've heard rumors about him using possibly small-yield nuclear weapons. what would the international ramifications against America be if something like that were to happen?
Well, I think it would be a disaster. There are a number of pieces of legislation in place, including something that I have introduced, which tells this president that we have a constitution in the United States of America, and that he would be precipitating a huge constitutional crisis if he thought he could simply attack Iran without getting the authority of the United States Congress. If he came to Congress, I do not believe that he would get that authority, and that's where we are right now. So that's the situation there. But if he attacked Iran, God, it would be just, I think, starting a war between the United States and the Islamic world.
Robin in Robin in Pinckney, Washington. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hi.
Robin. Hi. I'm in Michigan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just thought I'd correct that.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell me what Joe Lieberman's role has been in sort of softening the Democratic response to how they're going to deal with Iraq, whether he's kind of playing a I don't know how to exactly describe it, but whether he's kind of making it hard for Democrats to forcefully argue a position against the war by him threatening to caucus with the Republicans if they go too far.
Yeah. Hard to say. I don't know that I can give you a definitive answer. I think that's probably not the case. Obviously, there are fears that Lieberman would flip. What I hear is that that is not going to happen.
I know the Senate rules this time are different. Than
the Senate rules are different, too, but it would not be a good thing.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the essential problems that we have is you have, more significant than Lieberman, is you have, you need 60 votes to stop cloture. We were unable to get the 60 votes even to deal with a non-binding resolution. And what many of us are now looking at is how we use the budget to bring our troops home as soon as possible and raise the whole question of the president's authority to escalate a war which is based on a very different need than what he misled us into when this war began.
27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls right after this.
Guys, again, we're going down the wrong road, my friend. Let's return our nation to its true destination. Let's be the good guys again.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's a program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Jude in Seattle, Washington. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning to both of you. Senator, first of all, thank you for everything. My concern is the private prisons, the Corrections Corporation of America, being under the Homeland Security. How can we be sure that all of, you know, that we're just not going to become a huge prison state? You know, they have the two detention centers now that are housing children. The families are seeking asylum, and I have grave concerns about this, among many others.
Well, Jude, thank you for raising that issue. If my memory is correct, we have more prisoners per capita, I think, than any other country on earth. Tom, is that your understanding?
Yeah, it is. We used to be competing with China and South Africa and the Soviet Union back in the old days, but I think that we're, on a per capita basis, now number one in the world.
I mean, if you just take a just think about that. More people in prison than an authoritarian country like China. And that's just an outrage that has to be addressed. And I think there are a couple of points. I think you raised the concern about, I think, the privatization of our correction system, and I share that concern. When you put people behind bars for long periods of time, in some cases, for breaking the law, it should be the government, in my view, that is in charge of those systems and not some private corporation whose main goal is to make as much money as they possibly can. Second of all, we do continue to do a terrible job in rehabilitating many of the prisoners who are there, and rate of recidivism remains incredibly high. So what we do is we don't provide the education, we don't provide the training, we don't provide the housing, we don't provide the transition. And these guys get out of jail, then they do their drugs and they're back in jail at great expense to the taxpayers and harm to our country. And thirdly and most importantly, there was a study that came out a couple of weeks ago, I think, which pointed out what the cost of childhood poverty in America is. You go to any good police officer in America and he will tell you, who are the 7-year-olds who will eventually end up in jail. I mean, you can see at a very early age, kids who are into destructive activity, self-destructive activity, their family life is very bad, their schools are bad, they're gonna turn off from education at a very early age, they're gonna drop out from school. You know where they're gonna end up? They're gonna end up in jail. So having the highest rate by far of any other major country in terms of childhood poverty is one end of the spectrum, and the other end is that we end up having the highest rate per capita of people in jail. And clearly we want to get to the root cause of this problem and deal with childhood poverty.
Brian in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. What a pleasure it is.
Thank you, Brian.
Now, with a non-binding resolution, it didn't get our 60 votes. They're talking about introducing legislation to limit Bush's power. That's not going to get 60 votes, unfortunately. Bush is going to be requesting money to keep funding Iraq. Can we do something along the lines as introduce that limitation of his power and put it as a rider on his money request? It's time to roll them sleeves up and get dirty with these guys.
I think you're right, Brian, and I think that's what a number of us are now looking at, is how we use, and I can't tell you I'm the world's greatest expert on it, but what is the mechanism by which we use the budgetary process to do two things. Number one, so long as our troops are in harm's way, they get all of the equipment and everything else they need. But we use the budgetary process to bring them home, not keep them there indefinitely. So to answer your question, yes, that is what some of us are looking at.
Wayne in Eugene, Oregon. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Getting back to the veterans, Walter Reed, I've got another question on that for Senator Bernie, and that is that for years now, they've been coercing people with those conditions that they can get out at any time they want out of those conditions just by waiving their rights to medical care and further VA benefits. And I'd like to know how many of those wounded soldiers have been coerced out of those benefits, you know, just by leaving them in those places until they waive their benefits, and if there's any way we can restore their medical and other VA benefits to those people who have been coerced out of that place by those conditions.
Well, these guys right now are not in the VA. The Walter Reed Hospital is part of the Department of Defense. It's a DOD facility, and I don't think any of them are being forced out of the system at this point. The question that you raise, though, is what happens to some of them 5 years from now and 10 years from now when, in fact, they do go in to a VA facility? Will they have the kinds of resources that they need? Will they be placed on waiting lists? Will the institutions be funded appropriately? The bottom line of the VA is that, in fact, if you get into the VA, the care you get is pretty good. In fact, we just had the Secretary of VA before our committee a couple of weeks ago, and here he was, you know, citing statements that people, medical experts, regard VA healthcare some of the best in the country, which was kind of interesting because this is socialized medicine, I should tell you. And I thought it was amusing that he was touting socialized medicine as being some of the best in the country. The problem is that the VA, especially under Bush, has been significantly underfunded in general, and now with so many wounded soldiers coming back with a very large number, in addition to the wounded physically coming back with PTSD or traumatic brain injury, I worry very, very much as to whether or not we're going to have the capability and the resources to deal with these guys. And I should tell you, as a member of the Veterans Committee, we are working, I think, with some success at this point to significantly increase the veterans budget.
Betty in Ronald, is it Ronard Park, California, Betty?
Ronard Park.
Ronard, thank you.
Hooray for you, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Betty.
Because of the lack of funds for veterans, I believe that everyone in this administration should have to forego their pensions and monies they have profiteered over this illegal war, and that money go for veterans' help. and medical resources. Is it possible, or would it need legislation?
Well, Betty, I think we need to provide substantially more funding than their pensions would amount up to. We are now working on a budget for veterans, which would be something like $4.5 billion more than we have recently seen. So we are going to try to substantially increase funding for the VA so that all of our veterans, not just the Iraqi veterans, but all of them get the health care and the other benefits they need. We want to hire more people to process claims, because a lot of veterans put in claims and it takes them months and months or years to get adjudicated. And that's what we are working on. And I hope that we're going to have some success this year.
Ken in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, my question to Mr. Sanders is that it's my understanding that the legislature branch are supposed to make laws, not Bush signing statements making laws. Can't you guys repeal, like, the Patriot Act and all the other things that he has undone, the Constitution?
Ken, that's a very, very good point. You know, of the many criticisms that I have of the Bush administration, which I think will go down in history as certainly one of the very worst administrations in American history, if not the worst, one of them is their consistent attack on the Constitution of the United States. My hope and expectation is that committees like the Judiciary Committee, both in the House and the Senate and other committees, will be taking a hard look at all of the legislation and the actions of the Bush administration that undermine our Constitution. What Ken is talking about is the so-called signing acts that Bush does. And what Bush is doing here, and I want people to understand this, is he is signing a piece of legislation that often comes out of compromise debate, and he signs it. He says, well, I'm going to sign this bill, but, you know, I happen not to agree with provision number, 83, and I'm not going to enforce that. And that is beyond comprehension. That is not, Ken's point is exactly right. Congress makes the law. If the president signs the bill, he doesn't pick and choose the provisions that he wants to enforce. The whole bill is enforced. If he doesn't like it, he can veto it. And this is one of the many outrages of the Bush administration in undermining the separation of powers and the Constitution of the United States.
Well said. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jim in San Mateo, California. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. One thing that terrifies me about this president is I believe we have now two battle groups, if not three, in the Persian Gulf. Would they be setting up a Gulf of Tonkin scenario where if we're fired upon, or if they even create a scenario in one of our ships, that it would be put on as, we have to go to war because we were fired on?
Well, Jim, that is a very reasonable question, to be frank with you, and that is something that some of us are concerned about. What you're asking is the president trying to provoke the Iranians into an action by which the United States would then be obliged to respond? That's a legitimate concern. All that I could say is that a number of us are working very, very hard to make sure that Bush does not attack Iran. We have made it very clear in legislation and in other ways that he has got to come before Congress to get authority to do any military action against Iran. I do not believe he would get that authority, and that's the direction that we're going.
Yeah, but he may be able to just claim it. I mean, then Congress would have to act.
Then you got a huge constitutional crisis.
Right. Yeah. Okay. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie segment, the first hour of every Friday, noon Eastern Time, 9 Pacific Time. Your calls. Live with Senator Bernie Sanders here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line.
We're going to keep a close watch on this administration, I'll tell you. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls for the first hour of our program every Friday. Has been for the last 3 years. Bernie, I just want to tip my hat to you for this. I'm a congressman, a United States senator, taking just blind calls from people calling from all over the country. It's marvelous that you're willing to do this.
Thank you.
Tony in Los Angeles, California, you are live with Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, Senator Sanders. I just have a quick thing for you. One, you mentioned constitutional crisis a lot, and I don't know what that means. And two, when the president presents you with a budget, are you able to just throw that entire budget out and say this thing doesn't work and we create our own, or do you have to work within a certain kind of guidelines?
In terms of the second one, you have guidelines. You know, there are certain committees that handle certain functions. But you can, if your question is, can you totally revise the president's budget from A to Z? Yes, you can.
Okay. And then
that's the question.
By constitutional crisis,
what I mean is we have a constitution which provides separation of powers, and the power to make war rests with the Congress, not with the president. And, in Iraq, I voted against the war in Iraq, but the truth is the president came in, he got the authority to do it. He certainly, in my view, does not have the authority to attack Iran, and that would provoke a major, major constitutional crisis.
And that could, for example, extend to the House and the Senate, even talking about impeachment or something.
Yes,
like that.
I think so.
Yeah, okay. I think that was really the question.
Is that
code for impeachment?
Yeah, I mean, there comes the point, yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Bob in Clifton, Tennessee, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator. I also am concerned with the huge prison population. And it seems to me that we have a lot of nonviolent offenders in prison, particularly as part of the war on drugs. And I wonder if you think that a modification of the war on drugs is in order.
I do, Bob. That's a very good question. If we understand that it costs a heck of a lot of money to keep people in jail, that generally speaking, when you send people to jail, they're going to come out a lot worse shape than when they went in terms of learning a lot of bad habits. Keeping people out of jail is the right thing to do. And if you're having people who have not committed a violent act against somebody else, how you punish them without putting them in jail is something that we should consider. And by the way, a number of states are doing just that. They've reached the conclusion they can no longer afford to send people to jail, so they're coming up with strict parole systems and other mechanisms to keep track of people, but are trying to keep them out of jail.
Yeah. And we need a lot more treatment with regard to drugs.
That is a huge problem. I know in the state of Vermont, for example, right now we're seeing, and we are, thank God, a kind of a low-crime state, but we're seeing a rash of burglaries which the police believe, and I think they're absolutely right, are related to, in this case, prescription drugs, people getting addicted to OxyContin and so forth.
Yeah. Ian in San Francisco, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I just wanted to bring to your attention something that I've learned through some research, and that is that the State Department and the Defense Department allow, on a case-by-case basis, dual citizens to be given security clearances and work, be employed by those two departments, even at the highest levels. Again, it's case by case, but I'm just was wondering, are you aware of that? And is there anything that Congress could do to at least look into that policy to determine exactly, you know, how it's being applied?
Ian, to be honest with you, I am not aware of that. And it is something that could be looked into, but I am not aware of it.
Okay. Doug in Staten Island, New York, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much, Senator Sanders. I was so happy to be a contributor to your campaign, and I wish we could clone you and Senator Feingold.
Thank you.
Two things, and to you, Tom, also. I would double-check with Amnesty International and Human Rights. I believe we have gone from not just the largest prison population per capita, but to the largest prison population, period. Again, considering that China is still a closed society. The other thing, please check out Ward 54. Get Mark Benjamin. I spoke to you about that last week. Talk about that. These guys that are in there that are homicidal and suicidal. Also, if you go to
Doug, do you have a question for Bernie?
Yes, I do. Do you think, from what I've heard from vets that I know, they think it would be better to get the people that are deciding the disability percentages back into the VA, not the DOD, because they're trying to save money for bombs and bullets. And when you go to see them this week, they're in Building 14. They moved these guys out from Building 18, and they're not supposed to talk to the press.
Yeah. Well, there has been a general effort on the part of the Bush administration and, frankly, administrations before them. The one way you save money is you don't give veterans the benefits to which they deserve. And you do that by saying, well, you know, your injury or your problem is not really related to your medical service. These are judgment calls, and the Bush administration has been moving in the direction of making it harder for people to get the benefits that they are entitled.
Indeed. Roger in Bellevue, Washington. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom and Senator Sanders, for both your work. I have a concern about when Congress knew about the preemptive strategy, when it played into the intelligence analysis, and when it became apparent to those who would oppose America, and wouldn't it have been apparent just from the Project for the New American Century?
Well, you know, Roger, a number of us voted against giving the president the authority to go to war.
It was the majority of the Democrats.
A majority, you know, something like 58% of the Democrats did not, in the House then, did not vote to give the president the authority to go to war. What you had is almost unprecedented in American history, an effort on the part of this administration, to pick and choose, to cherry pick the intelligence that was coming down the pike. And that was so bad for so many reasons, not least of which it has compromised the intelligence agencies so that instead of doing the independent work that they are paid to do, and in fact often do quite well, what they were then trying to do is back up what the president and vice president wanted to do. Then you had the media working hand in glove to a significant degree, with few exceptions, with the Bush administration acting as a loudspeaker for their goals, and that's what happened.
Yeah, and tragically. Yep. Senator Bernie Sanders, our weekly national town meeting, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Always great having you on.
Bye-bye.
See you next week. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain.
Yeah, but don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. We're broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. CPAC.org is the website if you want to check it out. Earlier this morning, I had Sam Brownback talking to one of the talkers right next to me. It was wild. Right now, Rudy Giuliani's on the screen behind us, and you have to run a gauntlet of Romney people and Brownback people to get in and out of the room. With me here is an old friend who I ran into in the hotel yesterday, and it was like, Jonathan, what are you doing here? And he's like, Tom, what are you doing here? Jonathan Freeman from San Francisco. And Jonathan is a philanthropic activist. Would that be a good way to describe it? You're very involved in a lot of progressive causes and progressive activities and work to fund some of them as well. And, in fact, that's how we first met.
Right, exactly. Yeah, about 4.5 years ago, I helped put together a conference to address the legal structure of corporations. And you came on down, spent the weekend with about 50 or 60 other people, lawyers and other activists from all over the country who wanted to be involved in that issue, and that's something I've carried on.
Yeah, that was marvelous. That's where I first met David Cobb, who then went on to run for president on the Green Party, and David and I became good friends. And anyhow, Jonathan, it turns out I was asking you why you're here, and you said you're here to do a little personal espionage, as it were, maybe I'm misquoting you, but you were telling me yesterday afternoon some of the things I've been on the air 6 hours a day, and I haven't been able to go to the workshop, some of the things that you've been hearing, and I said, you've got to come on and tell my listeners about this. So I'm wondering, in particular, yesterday, I remember you were telling me about one workshop you went to where they were talking about how liberals are so effective at communication, and these are the strategies conservatives should use.
Yeah, this is there's a group here in Arlington called the Leadership Institute. And they do a variety of things. The particular portion that I sat in on was how to run for office and effectively bring your message to voters. Mm-hmm. And they kept saying over and over again that We conservatives aren't together. We don't bring the message from the issue all the way up to the voter, which involves putting a picture in their mind and eventually having the voter feel something, which is the way that people ultimately make their decisions.
Now, this is classic neuro-linguistic programming,
exactly.
NLP. I'm referring to it as cracking the code stuff. This is if you can cause people to have a picture in their mind and anchor that picture to a strong feeling, because people make their decisions based on feelings, but they hold their memories typically based on pictures, you've got something that they'll remember and they'll act on.
Exactly.
And this is what they were teaching.
So, pardon?
This is what they were teaching.
Right.
Yesterday.
They were doing it from the standpoint of values.
Mm-hmm.
And all the values about family and security and freedom and liberty and so on. Those are all words that they were using.
Yeah.
And so it was, they showed ads, particularly a Pataki ad, how it's done very effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And they were admonishing the crowd how to do that. So it was a fairly effective piece of teaching. And
yeah.
It was odd to hear them say, this is something we don't do on the conservative side, they do it on the liberal side. And all I've heard from our side is that on the progressive side, we don't do that well, and the conservatives do.
Yeah, I know. It's really quite remarkable. This morning at breakfast, I was down in the restaurant here in the hotel, and a woman went by with a little two-year-old kid, cute little kid, and he was wearing a T-shirt that in 3-inch tall letters, a white T-shirt in 3-inch tall black letters, said "Liberals lie."
Yeah.
What kind of message are you hearing when you go into these workshops about how we are being characterized by the folks who are here participating in this conference?
Well, I spent this morning listening to Duncan Hunter, who I believe is running for president, and then Jim Inhofe, mm-hmm. who is the senator from
Oklahoma.
Iowa. Who is the global warming...
yeah, I think it's Oklahoma.
Yeah, Oklahoma. He doesn't think global warming is happening. And there were flash pictures of Barbara Boxer on the screen, and people would boo.
And then anchor it to a negative emotion.
Yeah, exactly. And mostly the message I'm getting is that liberals and their ideas are bad. And there's a cornucopia of ways that conservatives reach that, and it's through the religion, believing that the Bible is correct. It's through the liberals who want to have abortion, and so they confuse women's rights and privilege with that, and a couple other things I can't recall offhand. But there is a lot of there seems to be a lot of animosity, unfortunately. I met yesterday with a fellow from a group called Reuniting America, which are trying to bridge this divide.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that here at CPAC is not a corporatocracy conservative. It is a Ronnie Reagan conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Small government, stay out of our lives, and don't bother us sort of viewpoint. And but he talks about how this fellow I met with talked about how there are a number of people in the conservatives who are opening up,
good.
And there are ways to bridge back and forth now, and so that's been a large part of the reason why I'm here as well, to meet with him and a few other people that are in Reuniting America, which is a wonderful group. Grover Norquist is involved in that one, I think, and Bob Barr.
I talked to Bob Barr this morning. In fact, he's going to be on the program in a little bit. In fact, this morning he said that if Bush, in fact, did violate the FISA laws, that's an impeachable offense, and Bush has bragged about it. So.
Right. Well, Barr left the...
he left the Republican Party, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that I thought was interesting that you and I, when we met yesterday, you were telling me about some of the things you've been to was this... was it a conference, or was it somebody talking about sustainability of corporations? We need to figure out how to keep corporations from being an endangered species.
Oh, this is what I told you yesterday. There was a meet and greet the other night, and people asked what I do, and I said that I had started a group called the Institute for Corporate Sustainability because, well, we're not going to get rid of any corporations anytime soon, so we've got to sustain them. Because if they keep using up all the resources that we have, we're not going to have corporations or even human beings around. And they agreed. They knew exactly what I was talking about. So it's a different way of languaging.
That's interesting because you created what is basically a progressive institution to rein in corporate power. And they're thinking of it as something to what? What their goal would be to hand more power to corporations.
Actually not. No, with the Ronnie Reagan Democrats here, they're not neocons. They don't like the fact that mom and pop retail and businesses are getting pushed out.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, they
interesting.
Don't.
You're hearing a lot of that.
They're quite concerned about that, and they're quite concerned about corporations in that regard.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, this fellow yesterday...
You need to get right on the mic here, Jonathan.
Okay. He showed me he showed me a bumper sticker which said, I love my country, but I fear my government. A number of corporate conservatives here are concerned about their individual liberty rights being taken away because of the war on terror.
Yeah, so they're turning their back on... I've had a couple... Actually, yesterday we had a couple of conservatives say that they were turning their back essentially on Bush over this issue, over these issues.
Right.
Yeah. And now they're also doing their straw poll. I mean, it's just been nuts here with all these presidential candidates running around.
Right.
Any sense of what's going on with all that?
That the only thing I know about that is, as Joseph told me, which was that that's basically a looking at the issues. I have no idea what's going on with the particular candidates involved.
Okay. And you went to hear Dick Cheney last night?
Oh, yeah.
Did you feel a deep rumble in your bones when you walked into the room?
No, it was.
I noticed the entire hotel got a little dim around 7 o'clock. Was that when he entered the building?
It was quite dramatic. It's quite dramatic.
DRA dramatic or TRA traumatic? Or both?
For me, it was traumatic, and I think it was dramatic. A lot of people really liked him. He got an applause at, whenever he stopped at a clause.
Uh-huh.
And took a number of different kinds of notes. So, do you have a break here?
We have. Actually, we have to wrap this up
He was going on about how the tax cuts have been great for the economy. We had 6 years of unprecedented growth, and GDP has gone up 16% with 7.5 million new jobs, and energy needs to be safe and affordable with supplies of energy. We need to push up our domestic oil production by going into Alaska and the Gulf. So we can double the size of the strategic oil preserve, which will, it's actually very tiny, won't last more than a week. So it was pretty dramatic hearing that that message.
Yeah, this Mr. Cheney, wow. I mean, that's like the right-wing part of the right-wing part of the right-wing message.
Yes, it is.
I mean, and he was very well-received. Yeah.
Yes, he was.
Okay. Yeah, it's fascinating to see all this stuff and how it's all shaking out. Jonathan Freeman. Jonathan, great to see you again.
Good to see you,
Tom. And I look forward to the next time, probably in San Francisco or someplace else.
Hope so.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks for dropping by and sharing your observations with our listeners.
Thank you, Tom.
It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back. The hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. We have Jim Dyke here with us. He is the executive director of TelevisionWatch.org. Hey, Jim.
Welcome. Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I am looking at your website, TVWatch.org, and first of all, you're saying parents, not government. This is the big headline: parents, not government. That you don't think that special interest groups should be able to force TV shows off the air. By and large, I agree with you.
Right.
I'm wondering what kind of reception you're getting here at this largely kind of, they call it socially conservative group.
Sure. It's been very favorable, actually. It is important to explain to people actually what we're talking about, because the easy way to look at this is there's bad television programming and kids shouldn't watch it and therefore it shouldn't be on television.
Right.
And actually I would agree with that. There are a lot of shows, obviously, that I wouldn't let my children watch on television. Not all shows are intended for children. But we have to take steps. We have to empower parents. We have to let them know about the information that exists to make informed decisions, and the tools that exist, remarkably, the technology that has brought us such a diverse opportunity to watch so many different things has also brought us the ability to control what comes into our home, what our kids can actually see.
Do you think that there should be, for example, there are there are different times of day that different kinds of programming are allowed. There are certain thresholds. I'm not super familiar with how it works on television, but I know in radio there are some things that can be said during prime time, or they cannot be said during prime time, and will draw a fine that could be said during non-prime time.
Yeah, that's...
Is that... So let me extend that.
Sure.
I remember in New York years ago, there used to be a local cable station that was like all nude all the time. I mean, they actually sit there and read the news in the nude kind of thing. You know, it was almost a pastiche. Are you suggesting that, for example, pornography should be on television at night?
Well, no.
Or during the day?
No. There are certainly rules that exist. But
that's government.
Typically, there is a role for government here, and there are boundaries, and those boundaries need to be enforced. But what's going on now is we're having a collapse of the boundaries. For instance, Saving Private Ryan. Should it not be on television?
There's a lot of obscenity in Saving Private Ryan.
The government couldn't decide.
Right.
So some shows didn't show it. So that's a type of violence. There are other types of violence on television.
Right.
The 9/11 documentary that was shown without a problem the first time it was shown, 2 years later, a number of ABC stations didn't carry it because they were worried about
the
whether or not it was going to be a problem.
This is all kind of the fallout from the Janet Jackson affair.
No question.
And Jim Dyke, I'm curious, who funds you? How did you come to this? Is this about reducing government, or is this about increasing access to
this is about reducing government interference in the decision making process on what's on television. We're funded by the broadcasters, the broadcast networks, that have brought together a coalition of 27 individuals and organizations representing over 4 million people.
Yeah.
The ACU is a member.
ATR
is a member. The ACLU is not a member, but they should be.
ACU. I'm sorry.
ACU, the American Conservative Union, Creative Coalition. We've brought together a group of strange political bedfellows that believe that parents have the power to make these decisions. And by the way, not only do they have the information to make informed decisions and then enforce those decisions, we're talking about just broadcast. Cable is not included in this regulatory scheme.
Oh, interesting. Why not?
Because they don't have the authority. The authority in the 90s.
Because the FCC doesn't have the authority. Yeah.
The government doesn't have the authority.
Yeah.
So,
although some 80-some-odd% of Americans, their television is delivered by cable, and cable uses our public rights of way, just like the airway. I mean, it's not the public airways, but it's the public rights of way.
Certainly, almost 90% of Americans either have cable or satellite television at this point.
Yeah.
And to that, those people have additionally robust ability to control what they see or what their kids. Remember, this is all about protecting the kids. The notion that this is even something that the government ought to be involved in is about making sure that kids don't see something that's not intended for them or is inappropriate, violent, indecent. And I think it's important to put that in context.
I think Sam Brownback would just take you down. I mean, he'd be totally...
Sam Brownback would disagree strongly. He believes that the government ought to be involved in these decisions.
Right.
He believes that the government ought to try and decide whether Saving Private Ryan ought to be on television.
That's right. And here at this conference, he's the standard bearer for the conservatives.
Yeah, he's one of them. I don't think we're a monolithic movement. I think if you look at our polling that we've done, overwhelmingly Americans across the board, conservative, liberal, north, south, agree that parents ought to be making these decisions. This is not a place where government needs to intrude and decide. Try to decide. How do you?
You know,
I can't decide what my wife and I ought to watch on television. More or less, what every family and their various age children ought to be watching.
Yeah. Good point. It has always seemed to me that conservatives are more concerned about private morality, what people are doing in their bedrooms, for example. Liberals are more concerned about public morality. Do we have poor people among us? Are there hungry among us? And it almost seems like you're, in taking this position, backing away from that traditional conservative concern about private morality. What are people watching in their homes? And saying, no, we're not gonna do that.
Well, I also see the conservative position as being there are things, if government doesn't need to make decisions, if parents can make decisions, which are about a third of all television households,
then let's get government out of our lives.
No need for the government.
Interesting. Jim Dyke, he's the executive director of TelevisionWatch.org. That's the URL as well. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Robert Bitonato is with us. He's the editor, senior writer, excuse me.
Editor
and speaker. Holy cow, what a bunch of titles.
I am. I have many hats.
Yeah, for The New Individualist, which is a magazine published by the ObjectivistCenter.org. ObjectivistCenter.org, the, Objectivist, Ayn Rand.
Right. Okay. Now, although we've changed our name recently to the Atlas Society. And
a little closer to the market.
The Atlas Society. So it's, you can do atlassociety.org.
As well.
That's an easy
okay,
way.
Great. Your article in the current issue of The New Individualist, the March 2007 issue, starts out with this quote from William F. Buckley, Jr. "There's no commonly acknowledged conservative position today, and any claim to the contrary is easy to make sport of." Actually, you know, I don't know what year Buckley said that, but Buckley is pretty famous for endorsing Russell Kirk.
Yes.
Who wrote The Conservative Mind in 1953.
Yes.
And Kirk laid out a series of five, as I recall, maybe six, specific foundations of conservatism, that there need to be classes and order in society.
Right.
Number one. That social mobility should be slow and gradual and should not be easily available to the masses. Number two, that change should come slowly, as change in society, regardless of social ills. I can go through the
sure,
list.
Sure, sure.
But you know, there really actually is a conservative philosophy, isn't there?
Actually, Tom, if you go up and down the aisles at this conservative political action conference, I don't think that you're going to find two people here that are going to agree on everything, and I don't think that you're going to find any, more importantly, one principle on which all of these people are going to agree.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with that. So what you're suggesting really is that it's not that conservatism as a philosophy is inconsistent or incoherent, because it's relatively consistent going all the way back to Sir Edmund Burke.
Well, it depends on how you define
that. But the modern people who call themselves conservatives have created a mishmash.
Well, I don't even know that I would agree with the first premise. I am not a conservative. I am an advocate of what I call principled individualism, and that is one element in the conservative history. However, you find a whole bunch of other elements, and you just describe some of them. And the problem is that conservatism, as construed from the beginning, had a bit of the American Enlightenment individualism, and to that was added a whole mixture of premises that I think are just totally
Most of the early conservatism, you know, the Sir Edmund Burke conservatism, which the first chapter of Russell Kirk's book is an ode to
Edmund Burke.
To Edmund
right.
Burke, right.
Sure.
And in fact, Thomas Paine wrote his entire book, The Rights of Man, as a rebuttal to
Absolutely.
The 2 weeks he spent at Burke's house in 1790, whatever it was. And he was so PO'd at Burke that he wrote an entire book putting him down. And it's a brilliant book, by the way, The Rights
sure.
of Man. I mean,
absolutely.
It's a classic. But it really wasn't until the 1930s and Franklin Roosevelt that the things that Paine suggested in The Rights of Man, you know, progressive taxation, social security, old age retirement programs, national health care, proposed later by Harry Truman, tariffs, that was taken on right from the very beginning. But, you know, Paine basically was the uber progressive or the uber liberal, as it were. Burke was the uber conservative. Guys would come down on the side of Burke.
I would say that those two guys do not exhaust the logical possibilities.
Okay.
I would say that Edmund Burke's,
you got me.
Edmund Burke's traditionalism and what you call the uber progressivism of Thomas Paine, there is an Enlightenment individualist tradition, which is sort of in the middle of all
yeah,
of
John
that.
Yeah, John Locke was sort of
right,
the
exactly.
For it.
The Lockean perspective.
But John Locke also put property above human rights. His original quote, which Jefferson borrowed and mangled, was life, liberty, and private property.
Sure. Now, let me say this about that, as a former figure would have said. The issue of rights, and I view this as an embodiment of the principle that we all understand called good fences make good neighbors. Unless there are boundaries in society, unless there are inviolate boundary lines across which we cannot morally progress.
In other words, unless we define this is mine, that's yours.
Absolutely. Unless we define the difference between mine and yours, and we define it in some sort of an absolute sense, then what happens is, in erasing those borders and those boundary lines, we find people becoming predators on each other.
Oh,
inadvertent.
I absolutely agree with you. Right. However, where I think you guys are missing the boat, respectfully, mm-hmm. and many of the conservatives, is the ours. You know, one of the famous objectivist statements is, "I didn't sign no stinking social contract." You know,
well, I don't know if that's an objectivist. I don't know if that's an objectivist stuff.
Or it's a libertarian.
Yeah, sure,
you know,
sure, sure.
And libertarians grew out of the objectivists to a large extent.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and that was the concept of the Enlightenment that, to a large extent, Burke was pushing back against, was the idea that we are a community, that we are here together, and mm-hmm. that was the idea that, you know, John Adams arguably was more of a libertarian or a conservative. But,
yes.
But certainly
mm-hmm.
Jefferson and Madison and George Washington were flaming liberals for their time.
Absolutely.
And they absolutely believed in community, that we were a nation of barn builders, not Davy Crockett's.
But they were liberals in the classic tradition, which is different from the modern progressive liberal. And the modern progressive liberal is one who... As Henry Steele Commager, in his wonderful book, The Empire of Reason, discussed, he loved everything that the Enlightenment figures such as Jefferson and Washington and Madison said, except when he got into those property issues. And I think that the founders were far more prudent than the modern liberal, because the modern liberal, in looking for the ours, has progressively, if you will, erased that fence, that good fence that makes for good neighbors.
Well,
and that is that
for example,
concept.
The taking of my income by virtue of taxes to mm-hmm. pay for care for somebody who is born with a birth defect through Social Security.
Why should Robert Bidinotto be taxed to benefit Tom, and why should Tom be taxed to benefit Robert for things that were not the responsibility of either individual? And why?
Because we're both members of a society.
This is the difference between our liberalism and yours. And the difference between our liberalism and yours, Tom, is that we regard individuals as ends and not means. And when you talk about members and membership in a society, you're talking about a cog in a wheel. You're talking about somebody who is supposed to be serving.
No, I'm talking about a member of a family.
Yes, and you're talking about the rationale for the existence of the individual is to be a member and to serve that family.
Not to serve it, but to participate in it. I would submit mm-hmm. to you that not only do none of us stand alone, but that mm-hmm. if any of us tried to stand alone, we would die, that we are social animals.
Of course we need... we don't disagree with that, but we did disagree with the idea...
But at the level of policy, you do.
Well, because of the premise. The premise is that of ends and means. And what is the end? If society is the end, then you are right. If society is not the end, if the individual is an end, then I'm right.
Right, and I'm saying that the individual alone would die, just like if you took one kidney out of your body and set it on the table and said, okay, there's part of my body, it's going to die.
The only way that individuals, though, can work together for that goodness that you talk about, that civilization, that kind of society in which we are all mutually supportive and enriching and non-predatory to each other, is if that boundary line is respected. And the problem with the left today, and my problem with the people in this room, the CPAC conference today, is that, quite frankly, the CPAC people are coming to resemble you guys a lot more than they are those classical liberals. The fault that I pick with these folks is that they're sounding an awful lot more like you these days, Tom,
right.
and that's my problem.
They want to know what you're looking at in the privacy of your bedroom and what you're smoking, and I want to know what you're paying in taxes, right? Those are your objections on both sides.
my objection, a pox on both of the houses because, quite frankly, the premise is both of you guys believe that the individual is to be sacrificed for your agenda, and we don't.
I understand that, and you've made the point several times. We're talking to Robert Bidinotto. He's the senior writer, speaker, editor of the New Individualist Magazine, ObjectivistCenter.org, and the Atlas Society.
Correct.
And Robert, we have 7,000 years of written, recorded history that we know of, and if you look at quote Stone Age people or Aboriginal Indigenous people who have been living the same way for literally 50,000-60,000 years. I mean, there are societies, the San of Central South Africa, for example. We know that society is 50,000 years old and still intact.
Certainly. Mm-hmm.
In all of that time, can you name any society that has succeeded by following your principles? Because I can name a whole bunch of them that have by following mine.
I don't know what you consider to be and construe to be success. I would say that
I'd say survived more than a few hundred years as a society.
I would say that the what we have and what we are seeing today is the last gasp of a tribal legacy. And an ethic which grew out of the needs and requirements for immediate physical survival of tribes and groups and small groups of people. With the Industrial Revolution, with the creation of enormous amounts of wealth, much of that, if there was ever any argument for a tribal
no,
type
I'd say
of ethic,
our tribes,
it's gone.
I'd say tribe is family in our community, and it's being fractured by the Industrial Revolution, that we're in more need than ever of tribe.
I couldn't disagree more, because that has allowed people the opportunities as individuals to forge relationships that would have been impossible to them prior to the existence of the Industrial Revolution.
To the benefit.
The communication abilities, the abilities to integrate along social lines where we can make friendships and forge opportunities.
We both salute technology.
That is a good thing.
Okay,
and
we'll
I want the
that.
Social system will allow it.
There you go. Robert Bennato, the website objectivistcenter.org, the New Individuals magazine, and the Atlas Society. Thanks for being with us, Robert.
Thank you so much, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Antique Freedom! Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, sitting right here with me. It's so nice to
hang out with CPAC.
You. Yeah, here we are in the belly of the beast.
That is the belly of the beast. Although one prominent Republican said to me that the reason that they try and get the ACLU and the Muslim whatever here is so that they can kind of keep the crazies from being too crazy. That was actually said to me by a Republican here.
Wow, wow. Now, Sam Brownback was broadcasting from the booth right next to me about 2 hours ago, and he had, 50 people here chanting Sam Brown, and just, the whole cheering squad. This straw poll, this vote that's going to happen, for our listeners who might have just tuned in, this is Tom Hartman. We're broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Committee, the CPAC, CPAC.org. This is an old thing. They've been doing this for a long time.
Years.
Yeah. In fact, the guy, the engineer who set up the Radio Row here, said he's been doing this for 10 years. So, yeah. And they do a straw poll, and that straw poll determines what?
Well, the straw poll essentially means that all the people here get to vote, and it has a lot to do with moving money around here. Because although, as you can tell, the demographics here are predominantly younger, it has a lot to do with who comes out of here and who sort of in that conservative community people like. Now, I had a conservative tell me they actually think Giuliani is going to win that straw poll.
Really?
Is he here? He is
here.
He made a speech this afternoon.
Oh, okay. So that's what I was seeing on this TV monitor over here. I thought it was just they were playing a loop.
Oh, no. And he talked about workfare. He was talking about hope. He spent a lot of time on education. And then he talked about the Patriot Act. And he felt that they have to have electronic surveillance. He said it has to be legal. But he said that the only
Giuliani
way...
Giuliani wants to be a good little Nazi. I mean, this...
They were able to get the Gambino family was essentially, he said, they didn't come in and tell me things. He said you had to breach their privacy. He said we had to go to Italy, and that's the only way we could break them.
But they got a court order to do it.
Of course.
But Giuliani forgot to mention that in his speech, I'm guessing.
And then Ted Olson has actually just signed on to the Giuliani campaign. So I think that that's pretty interesting.
Ted Olson, the guy from the Reagan and Bush administrations.
Solicitor General of the United States.
Former Solicitor General, yeah. His wife died in 9/11.
She was actually, I really liked her. She was somebody I used to spar with on Fox. And she's actually, she had right-wing ideas. but very, very nice lady.
Yeah, I've heard that, but I've heard that he is also a real pit bull. He's a real attack dog.
Oh, he's the kind of guy. Unfortunately, he's a smart attack dog.
Yeah.
They got a million attack dogs here. This guy is very, very smart. I mean, he does Supreme Court cases like you and I might have candy.
So if Giuliani comes out of the straw poll here at CPAC as the winner, and you know, it's very, real interesting, the Romney thing. You know, they've got Flipper. In fact, we had a picture taken of me and Flipper earlier for
right.
Talkers Magazine. And saying, you know, Romney flip-flops on the issues. But there's all these clean-scrubbed, you know, young Romneyites out there passing out the literature. And then there's the Brownback folks. And there's, you know, everybody.
And McCain did not show up. But as you said, you got something under the door. And then today, McCain said, his people said, sort of behind the scenes, that they really expected Giuliani to fade. And that they think McCain will surge when he announces his candidacy in April.
Interesting. But whoever comes out of the straw poll is, there's going to be a lot of wealthy conservatives who are going to be looking at that going, okay, this is the guy that I should support for president because he can carry the conservative base. And if Giuliani is that, they know that he's a crossover candidate, that he won't just carry the conservative base, he can also carry a lot of the middle of the base, the old
Reagan
Democrats.
There's two kinds of money people, the true believers and the, I want to be an ambassador, so I'm going to raise $250,000 to $1 million
right.
So I get a position on a commission or ambassador or whatever.
Right.
And those people go for where they think the presidency is going to go. They don't care about ideology.
That latter category.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's the true believers who do care about the ideology.
Right. So, and
then there's, of course, the ones that believe who and so-and-so is going to win against the Democrats.
Right. And which brings us to the polls that, and again, we're so early in this, it just seems crazy to me that we're even talking about it. But nonetheless, this is here, it's playing out right in front of us.
We're doing another straw poll here next year.
Yeah, I mean, it's just playing out right in front of us. And the polls seem to show that if Giuliani is the Republican candidate, that he's and Hillary Clinton is the Democratic candidate, that he would give her a real run for her money.
That is why a lot of Republicans would vote for Giuliani, because they feel like if you put up a Brownback against Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton is going to win, no
right.
question.
Because Sam Brownback he appeals to too narrow a minority of Americans.
And the question is McCain and his age. I think that is what I'm hearing quite a bit about.
Oh, they're starting to think that McCain is, you know, just a little over the top.
Exactly.
You know, he's a little
exactly.
Yeah, interesting. Well, and occasionally he seems to show it, but.
Two other things today. The president went down to raise money for Mitch McConnell, who's running for Senate again in Kentucky. And before he left, announced that, and tomorrow his radio address is going to be about veterans health care, and he announced a commission to look at both Army and veterans hospitals on vets health care.
Gee, what a surprise.
Yeah. Put it in a commission and make it go away.
Shove it over into the corner over there. Giuliani versus Hillary, I mentioned that, but I heard yesterday that Giuliani versus Obama, actually Obama would be a stronger candidate against Giuliani than Hillary as of the way it's looking right now. Did I get that right, or did
I'm
hearing so much political
right,
gossip
I have
here,
heard
know?
That the internal Hillary polls show that if Obama runs against anybody, he loses by 7 points. But as I think you and I were talking, that is the popular. What happens, and the Hillary campaign is very committed to Ohio.
Yeah.
They don't believe that Obama can win in Ohio. But don't forget, Obama's from Chicago.
Right, which is right next door.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Ohioans identify
yeah,
with
Midwest.
Illinois.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be an interesting year and a half here. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen,
for
being
with us.
Thank you. Always great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced.
And here we are deep in the belly of the beast, the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., CPAC.org, the website if you want to check it out, doing our radio row. And because somebody has to. I mean, so I think it's with our my friend Jonathan, who was here at the beginning of the last hour. I think it's important that we all know what each other are up to and what's going on all around here. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, click live chat. It'll get you in there. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Really quick, I just want to update folks on a situation Bernie talked about, mm-hmm. presidential signing statement.
Right.
Yeah, as I called back maybe 2 weeks ago, right after it blew up, the president signed a postal reform bill saying that he can essentially open mail without a warrant under certain circumstances.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
you're with the Postal Workers Union.
Yeah. Yeah. I created this kind of online group called Postal Workers United Against Tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
And I took my message, me and a couple guys from work, took our message to our local union. And last night, we became the first postal union in America to pass a resolution opposing this practice.
That's great. That's great. And Jeff, once again, for our listeners, the website that you created for this.
It's www.postalworkersunited.blogspot.com. And if you know a postal worker, or if you are a postal worker, it'd be great if you go on there and find out how to help us. And hopefully we won't be the last union to do this.
Yeah. Amen. Okay. Jeff, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Robert in San Francisco, California. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to mention to you that the 9/11 Truth Alliance has done a lot of work over the last 5 years, and we've uncovered some things that your listeners need to be aware of, that the Keene-Zelikow Commission never investigated U.S. Air Force training exercises involving live flight hijackings of commercial airliners and planes crashing into buildings. And neither did they investigate the controlled demolition of the World Trade Tower complex as a factor in the 9/11 events.
Well, there's the list of things that weren't investigated as part of the 9/11 investigation is
that's because one of the top PNAC people, neocon people, Zelikow, was a gatekeeper and prevented any questions from being asked.
Yeah.
He said what could be asked and what couldn't be, and so
yeah. I'll tell you right up front, Robert. I have no idea. I mean, I don't know. Who did what? But what I do know is that we don't know,
and we
need to have a good, comprehensive investigation of what happened
in
9/11. Not just what happened in 9/11, but also why the Bush administration kept ignoring everybody who was telling them that this is going to happen. You know, I mean, the CIA flies a guy, especially down to interrupt George Bush's vacation in Crawford, Texas. I mean, this is relatively unprecedented that they fly this guy down there to personally deliver this, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the U.S. memo and brief Bush on this. And Bush pats him on the head and literally, I mean, this is a quote from the news, literally says, okay, you've covered your ass. You can go back to Washington, D.C. Like, I'm not going to take this seriously. Or I'm not going to do anything about this, but you're not going to lose your job. And it's like, you know, where were these people? I mean, if Bill Clinton had been in charge, had been president when 9/11 had happened, with 9 months of, I mean, Dick Cheney was in January of 2001 put in charge of two things. He was put in charge of the Energy Commission, and he was put in charge of the Counterterrorism Commission. The Counterterrorism Commission never met until September of 2001. I mean, if that had been Al Gore, he would have been crucified by now.
Well, you know, Representative Kucinich at Kucinich.us is receiving all evidence for first responders who were told by their superiors, if you know what's good for you, you'll keep your mouth shut, because they witnessed things in the basement of the World Trade Tower with police and firefighters that indicates those buildings were blown up. And there's a lot more evidence than just that.
Besides the fact,
we believe that's all backstory. All the Al-Qaeda stuff, all the warnings from all the different countries, all that stuff is backstory. And the PNAC promoted an attack upon the United States in order to galvanize the American people into an imperial mobilization, democracy being to imperialism, and in the grand chessboard by Zbigniew Brzezinski, that phrase appears 3 times.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's Robert. Thank you for the call and for raising the issue. And if Dennis Kucinich over at Kucinich.us is gathering that information, that's great. I was unaware of that, and thanks for the heads up on that. Dan over in Montpelier, Vermont, listening on WDEV. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I'm real glad to get a chance to talk to you. Your program really is making a difference out here. I can tell you that by the example you set. But
I got a question for you, and it's kind of funny. You're down there at the Conservative Political Action Conference. Is that what
you said?
That's
right, yeah.
Well, that's pretty relevant, because the reason I called was I wanted to hear from somebody. I was going to ask Bernie, but he's not on now. I was going to ask you, how do we find a way to get conservatives to start to hear, let's say, liberals as humans instead of just branding us as basically stupid as soon as we say something that they can kind of tag quickly as a liberal notion, then they just kind of dismiss everything that we have to say. And I think we may do the same going back toward conservatives. I'm going to guess that we do.
No, it's one of the reasons why I try to have conservatives on this program from time to time and have conversations with them. I think that the first thing that we have to do is recognize that we're all humans here. And that it's interesting, yesterday, one of the best conversations I had with one of the conservatives I was debating yesterday was off the air. It was with Craig Bannister, who is the booker. He just dropped in and we talked for about 5 minutes about, you know, the strategy the conservatives use to get their message out. And he's the guy who when we're looking for conservative guests, he's kind of the go-to guy with his public relations company. And after we got off the air, and we were talking about this, after we got off the air, he said, you know, you and I want the same thing. He said, we both want clean air. We both want clean water. We both want everybody in this country to have good health care. We both want our children to live in a better world. We both want a world of peace. We just disagree on how's the best way to get there. And he meant it with entire sincerity, but I would suspect that probably a year or two ago, before we started interacting with these guys a lot, that they, you know, I can't speak for Craig, and you know, he probably may have thought that all along, but you know, a lot of folks, if they have no contact, if they're not challenged, if no discussion happens, you know, they just, you know, they think of us as cartoon characters. And it's very easy for, frankly, people on our side to think of conservatives as cartoon characters. And so I think the beginning point, Dan, is we have to recognize our common humanity and our common goals, and then have rational discussions about how are we going to accomplish that. You know, is the free market the very best way to deliver health care? We've been trying it in this country for the last 50, 60 years, you know, since health care has become a real issue, and it doesn't seem to work quite so well. There's other countries that have tried other routes. Maybe we should learn from them. You know, what's the best way to backstop people in their old age? And Social Security seemed to work really well. The conservatives have been taking a whack at it. You know, maybe we should be strengthening it rather than doing away with it. All these kind of things. I think that, you know, it's the theater of the mind, the theater of ideas, and it's important that we carry that on. Thanks a lot for the call, Dan. I appreciate it. Carol in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
Well, I had hoped to talk to Bernie, but maybe you can ask him for me. He said a few weeks ago, I've been listening to your program for as long as it's been on, and it's one that I never miss, even if it means I don't get my housework done.
Oh, well, thank you, Carol.
Yeah. I'm very involved with democracy groups here. We mm-hmm. have a local congressman, Catwell, who's told our state legislature that she will not entertain anything they have to say about impeachment of Bush. And that has been recently, because there has been some work in the legislature.
Well, Nancy Pelosi has essentially said the same thing. She's taking impeachment off the table.
Yes. Well, I just want to know why Sanders thinks that even though he says that the public is a little ahead of the legislatures and the Congress, why he thinks we don't want to see this administration impeached. Because I am extremely...
Well, I've never heard Bernie say that.
Said that 2 weeks ago. He said that that there were other issues on the board, and that the Congress isn't ready for that yet.
Well, I'll have to try and make sure you get on the next time you call, and you can ask him that question.
Because
it would be inappropriate for me to speak for Bernie, and frankly, I don't know. I do know that the conventional wisdom among Democrats, and I think they're wrong, is that if they get into an impeachment process with Bush, that it's going to so distract and it's going to so polarize that it's going to ultimately hurt the Democratic cause. And I think, frankly, that it'll invigorate it. But I may be wrong. I mean, I'm not a political consultant. I'm a talk show host.
Same issue about the supporting the troops.
Yeah.
I think that means that they shouldn't be supplying any more money to them so that they can get home.
Now, on that regard, there are a lot of the majority of Democrats support you. The problem is, in the Senate, they need 60 votes. Carol, thank you for the call. They need 60 votes, and that means they need Republicans as well, and they're not going to get them. 16 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. 7,000 more. Yeah, Pentagon officials yesterday, this is from thinkprogress.org, Pentagon officials yesterday told a Senate committee that the president's escalation in Iraq will require 28,500 troops. This is from Marine Corps Times. That's 7,000 more than Bush has requested. 7,000 more. And some other interesting news, just from the ThinkFast summary. The share of female politicians around the world reached a record high of almost 17% in 2006. That's up 6% in the last 10 years, in the last decade. That, I think, is frankly a good thing. Nearly 90%, this is not a good thing, nearly 90% of National Army National Guard units in the United States are rated not ready, largely as a result of shortfalls in billions of dollars worth of equipment, jeopardizing their capability to respond to crises at home and abroad. Now, here we are, alternating bad news, good news, right? 56%, that's the number of Americans who believe the federal government has a responsibility to provide health care for all. 56% would say, yes, Medicare for all, or Medicaid for all, as the case may be. 84% said they support expanding the Children's Health Insurance Program. This is the one that Bush wants to cut, or did cut in his budget. Actually, you know, it hasn't been cut yet. It's got to go through Congress. And finally, Pete Domenici and Heather Wilson, good old Heather Wilson, apparently are the ones who got the U.S. attorney in New Mexico fired by the Bush administration. Let me back up a little bit. They're the ones who pressured the U.S. attorney in their state to speed up indictments in a federal corruption investigation because, now this was before the elections, because it involved a Democratic state senator. So here you have politicians intervening in federal prosecutions for political purposes. Heather Wilson, by the way, won by 875 votes out of nearly 211,000 cast in the state of New Mexico. And finally, from bad news to good news again, State Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid yesterday said he would likely support legislation by Jim Webb, a senator from Virginia, barring a U.S. attack on Iran unless Congress explicitly says to Bush, yes, you can do that. Mark in Kelso, Washington. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was just calling to say that if it was up to the public to impeach the president, then it wouldn't matter if our politicians didn't have the courage to do it or...
Yeah, it's really almost, you know, one of those things like in England or in most countries that have parliamentary systems.
Yeah, parliamentary systems.
Where if you could just say, okay, it's time for a vote of no confidence, you know, this government isn't going to stand.
I think that's exactly what we need.
Yeah, yeah. We need a national vote.
They're doing a lot. They've cleaned up the lobbying. I think that it needs to go as far as monitoring congressmen and senators, even their friends and their families.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you.
They could turn around and give it to their family member, and then after they're done being a congressman or senator, get it back from them. I mean, I think it needs to be really
The system, well, and frankly, because we're not going to have parliamentary democracy or the system of government, what we need to do, in my opinion, is get public financing of federal elections. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, thanks for waiting.
No problem. Thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, before I get to talk about what I called in about, quickly, the last thing the caller was talking about, I think what we could have is a national recall system, like we have recall for governors and things in certain states. We could do something like that. But with respect...
Well, some citizens are starting to do this. I mean, you know, in some states you've got local communities who are voting impeachment resolutions.
Oh, exactly, but they're non-binding.
I understand, but it still, you know, it still tells your elected officials, hey, we're thinking of this, we're talking about this, take this seriously, please.
But with respect to another matter, with respect to what I called in about immigration legislation, you know, the problem I have with it is tucked inside of it is Bush's seemingly anti-middle class guest worker program.
Right.
And, in fact, there were headlines yesterday in the New York Times that read, Bush aides pledged to work for an immigration bill, and there were similar headlines in USA Today. And
yeah, and then there was a story over the last couple of days in either the Washington Post or one of them about how the guest workers are being, people who actually are guest workers right now in the United States under a guest worker program that we have are being exploited.
Exactly, and that's exactly what goes to my concerns about any immigration legislation that has a Bush-backed and unfortunately democratically supported guest worker program in it, is that this is what it is to me. It's just what you said. It just tries to, first of all, it has nothing to do with immigration reform. All it is, it just tries to exploit cheap labor at low wages in order to increase corporate profits. And why it's being tucked into immigration reform legislation, you know, I really don't like that fact. And Mike, the question I was going to ask Bernie Sanders originally, I guess I could ask you, is there anything that can be done to either filibuster or otherwise stop or put a hold, like the, sort of the way individual senators can put a hold on nominees that Bush sends up? Is there anything that can
you know,
be done
it,
to
it
stop,
wouldn't surprise
stop
me, actually, Jerry, if that legislation does have a hold put on it, and it'll be put on by Republicans, not Democrats, frankly. You know,
something needs to be done.
I don't disagree. It's terribly flawed. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Committee, or conference, here in Washington, D.C., CPAC.org. And we'll be taking your calls. Maybe we'll get, we'll see if we can get Richard Vigory on. That should be entertaining. 27 minutes past the hour.
I got a friend named Whiskey Sam. He was my boony rat buddy for a year in Nam. He said, I think my country got a little off track. It took him 25 years to welcome me back. But it's better than not coming back at all. Many a good man I saw fall. And even now, every time I dream, I hear the men and the monkeys in the jungle scream, drive on. It don't mean nothing. My children love me and they understand. And I got a woman who knows a man. Drive on.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, keep on driving on. Democracy. We need to drive on. We need to move it forward. Frederick in Portland, Maine. Hey, Frederick. Thanks for calling the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. Hey.
And by the way, thanks for listening on WLVP there.
I love your understanding of the common good and the public good. Now, what I see Iraq and Katrina representing is the failure of conservatism. Iraq is essentially an attempt to privatize.
Yes. Oh, that, Naomi Klein wrote this brilliant piece, I think it was for The Nation magazine about 2 years ago, called Year Zero, Iraq Year Zero. And she just, it's been written about in other places, but she laid it out more brilliantly than anybody had ever seen before, and all in one piece, in probably about 4,000 words. Thank you. And I mean, just that the whole, you know, Bremer's whole mission there was to prove that the liberals, you know, of Harry Truman specifically, and George Marshall, were wrong when they did the Marshall Plan in Europe, and they encouraged Germany and Japan and other, you know, other European countries to have strong labor unions and essentially to protect the commons, to have national health care, all those things that Truman was working for here in the United States. You know, they and that, you know, it produced a wonderful result in Germany, and that was just in the minds of the conservatives, that was just a fluke. That was just, you know, the Germans rebuilt Germany because, hey, they're industrious people. And so they were looking for a country that was a tabula rasa, or however you say it, that, you know, on which they could, you know, a blank slate on which they could write a conservative world. And that's what he did. Paul Bremer, Bush's old Andover prep school roommate, went in there to Iraq and rewrote their constitution, which, by the way, is a violation of international law and international treaties. You can't rewrite the constitution of an occupied country. And did away with the progressive income tax, replaced it with a flat 15% tax, did away with laws, domestic content laws that said things sold in Iraq had to have at least part of it made in Iraq, allowed corporations to bring in labor from outside the country, essentially did away with all their immigration laws as it had to do with employment, so that the employers primarily large American contractors, could bring in labor from Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and Pakistan and, you know, places where they could find cheaper labor than they could find in Iraq. And they thought, they really believed, I mean, this is the scary part of Frederick, they really believed that doing all this would within 6 months turn Iraq into an instant libertarian paradise, that it would work out so well that they literally had no plan B. There was no plan for what would go wrong if this didn't work. They were so convinced it would work, and they were, and it had never been tried before any country in the world, and it's never been successful before, and it wasn't successful in Iraq.
Exactly, and here's Tom, the point that I want to make is I'd like to ask you to view this frame that you have of the public good. Can you talk about this like as you're leading a seminar, as you're leading a workshop on the progressive frame each week to educate us about the difference between the public good, what we hold in common, what we pay our taxes for, and then on the other hand, the privatization and private greed of conservatism? Because now here in Maine, they're members of the Democratic Party. There is a lot of talk about the progressive frame, exactly what you're talking about, but I have not heard anyone speak more clearly than you have, and I'd like you to hold it as a part of your weekly format to do work on this.
Frederick, I've been doing this. This month marks the fourth anniversary of this program, and it's my favorite frame. You know, it's I got it from Tom Paine from Reading the Rights of Man. Thomas Paine wrote about this in the 1790s. It's and actually you go back and you read Rousseau, you know, and John Locke, and you know the thinkers of the Enlightenment. And frankly, as you know, when I had the libertarian guy or the objectivist guy on before, I said, you know, can you name a society where your system has ever worked? And he punted. He avoided the question. He said, no, we're at the end of the tribalism here. But the fact of the matter is that the common good is the essence of every tribal society, and we are tribal animals. Family is wired into us. We're designed for this. So, Frederick, thanks for the call. I will keep on it. Not to worry. It's wired into me. It's part of my DNA. Julius in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Julius, what's on your mind today?
Well, first of all, I wanted to mention that I date myself. But one of the sponsors that I heard while I was waiting was SEIU.
Right.
And I was a member when there was a B in front of that.
So, oh, really? Okay.
Yes. But the main reason why I called, and I appreciate the fact that you're on in Detroit from 12 to 3. I used to get bits and pieces of your program on the weekend. But I'm so happy that you are now coming in on Detroit, in Detroit.
Yeah, well, so am I, and we tip our hat with thanks to WDTW for carrying our program live.
And this is and still one more point before I get to the main reason why I called, and that is I'm going to send some rockets into the universe so that your ratings just go off the roof.
Well, the main thing, Julius, is to let our sponsors know that you're listening.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, nothing wrong with letting the radio station know, too, but mostly it's, and particularly the local sponsors, support the local radio stations because that's where the rubber meets the road.
Yes,
so,
well.
So, anyhow, but what you called about, the topic
okay.
You called about.
I was listening to some of the debate that you were having with the conservative folks out there, or wherever you are.
Yeah, in Washington, D.C., at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
Right. Well, listening to you, I know that you've read extensively. Are you familiar with George Orwell's essay on the politics of the English language?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I want to mention...
It's easily Googled, by the way, and let me encourage all our listeners to find it. It's not particularly long. It can't be more than, what, 10, 12,000 words, would you say, at the most?
Right, right. And it's very, very interesting, especially I want to tie it in to the discussion that you had with the objectivists.
Right.
And that was one word, individual.
Right.
The original definition prior to the politics of the English language, in my opinion, the original definition was undivided, which certainly ties into what you were saying about the tribal, the societal norms, that we as human beings have.
Yeah, this is the fundamental cleavage between, by modern I mean like post-1600, modern conservative thought versus modern liberal thought. And that is that modern liberal thought And Jefferson and many of the other liberal thinkers of his era wrote about it. Ben Franklin was actually quite outspoken and eloquent about it. He looked at tribal people that they were discovering in North America, and other Europeans were looking at other tribal people that they were discovering in Africa, for example, and in South America. And they said, you know, a lot of these people seem to have a very good life. And, you know, Rousseau's noble savage idea. And, you know, why would that be? You know, what can we learn from them? What, you know, these people who have, by trial and error, figured out how to make a society work over a 10,000-year period rather than a few hundred years of you know, or maybe a 1,000 years of European history. And this idea that we're all in this together, that there is a collective good, and that we can't disassociate ourselves from family and tribe because you know, we're human animals. We're this is how we're wired.
Well, you know, that, once again, referring to how the language is used, if we look at the word communal, okay,
yeah.
And how they've made it like communism, you
right.
know, and the root word is common.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and that's the problem, you know, with Marxism and Karl Marx is, you know, Karl Marx, if you read Das Kapital, he correctly diagnosed the problem of capitalism, which is in part solved by regulating capitalism. I think Franklin Roosevelt literally saved capitalism from itself in the United States. But his diagnosis was right, but his prescription was wrong, because communism works if you have fewer than 150 people. If you have a small community, kibbutzes, for example, are communist societies. They work. They're small communities because everybody knows everybody. But once you get a society large enough that people can't, you know, that people can function anonymously, then the psychopathologies can come out. Then people can become predators and become anonymous predators. And then it's imperative to organize society in a way where we can watch out for each other. We can look out even when we don't know each other. Where you, Julius, in Detroit, and me here in Washington, and generally living in Portland, where we can be watching each other's backs with regard to, say, for example, making our food safe by having a U.S. Department of Agriculture make sure that our food is safe. Julius, I've got to move along. I appreciate the call, though. Thank you very much. Intelligent conversation always I find stimulating. Matthew in Los Angeles. Hey, Matthew. We have just a minute before we've got to take a break. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. It's great to hear from you. Great to hear you. The one thing I was calling about is that someone had mentioned that the state resolutions for impeachment would be non-binding. That actually isn't the case.
You're talking about Jefferson's rules?
Yeah, Jefferson's Rule 603, it says state legislatures, if they do pass an impeachment resolution, it would be automatically introduced to the House clerk, and
right.
it would become what they call privileged business, meaning that the representatives would have to take up the issue and either debate it, table it, or do something with it. Either way,
right.
we'd have an up or down vote. On
yeah, you're right. Assuming that Nancy Pelosi interprets those rules the way that Jefferson wrote them, A, and B, assuming that one of the states actually successfully gets a resolution. I mean, it's going to
right.
require, you know, both houses plus a governor to sign off on it. I'm very skeptical about any state having the ability to do that.
Well, New Jersey is the New Mexico is the closest. New Jersey's not.
Yeah, but I don't see Bill Richardson signing that.
Yeah. Well, that's another issue too. I'm not even completely sure that a governor needs to sign it. I believe it just has to pass the actual House and Senate. I'm not fully clear on whether the governor.
Yeah, I thought it had to be signed by the governor as if it was a piece of legislation, but I may be wrong. Matthew, thank you for the heads up and the clarification. You're spot on. You're absolutely right. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to my producer David Poole, to Louise, to Lauren and Julian in New York at Air America, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives for our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. This great news release I just got. This is Khan's gone wild. They concern has gone wild. Assemble circling circle firing squad. This from Toby Chatterjee, who is the Campaign for America's Future's communications director. He says, the president's base is bleeding and their blood is in the water. Conservatives are telling themselves that they need to get back to their ideological roots to gain political domination. But their roots are the problem. Voters who are drilled to believe the conservatives stood for fiscal discipline, small government, and ethical behavior were confused when their grip on power produced record budget deficits, catastrophic failures, and a series of indictments and departures. So, and then you look at the stats here. This is where America's at compared to where, for example, CPAC is at. 81% of Americans favor a federal minimum wage hike. 17 states have voted to raise their minimum wage just last year. 79% of American adults say Medicare should negotiate with drug companies for lower prices. 79%. I'm wondering where that, the 21% who say they shouldn't. I mean, what planet are they living on? 82% of registered voters believe global warming exists. 61% of adults say Congress should repeal tax breaks and subsidies to oil companies. 63% of Americans oppose sending troops to Iraq. 68% of Americans say the U.S. is headed on the wrong track. Incredible. So we'll see. We'll see how it shakes out. I smell change in the wind. Lots and lots of it. Gene in San Francisco, California. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Oh, great show these last 2 days. Thanks so much, Tom.
Well, thank you. It's been a wild ride.
Yeah. I wanted to say how I agree so much with you about the free trade zone in Iraq turning only into a free pass for predators.
Yeah.
Yeah, that point you're pressing on. I think when we deconstruct the Bush free trade and privatized disasters of Iraq and Katrina, we'll be able to see that a post-war, a post-disaster situation where the community has been broken down and chaos reigns, like you were pointing out,
This
is the perfect situation for predators to move
That's
and
right.
take
and
over and steal and corrupt.
Yeah, and it's not just a recent phenomenon, by the way. We saw the same thing happen in the United States after the Civil War, after Reconstruction, starting around 1880 with the rise of the robber barons, and it was the beginning of the end of the American middle class that had preceded the Civil War. And the result of that was that the progressives, the populists, the wobblies, the Grange movement, farmers getting together, all rose out of the 1880s, 1890s, 1900, so much so, and with such great force in the late 19th century, as the American middle class got wiped out, that when Teddy Roosevelt became president, when McKinley died in 1901, I think it was, when Teddy Roosevelt became president, here's a guy who was elected as vice president on a platform of Republican, rich, white guys for business, right? And he becomes the most progressive president probably in our history, or one of them. And in some ways, I mean, obviously there's some things you can criticize about Teddy Roosevelt's administration as well, but nonetheless. And in response to that, and then after Roosevelt leaves, boom, we go back to predatory capitalism and you know, laissez-faire capitalism. And until we had the Republican Great Depression, until the whole house of cards went crashing down in 1929, which led us to the modern progressive era from 1932 with the election of Franklin Roosevelt until 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan, who flipped us into a conservative era. And boom, the predators came out again. And now hopefully we'll be moving back in the other direction. But Gene, well said. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Good to hear from you. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. I know we're short on time, so I'll try to speed it through. The poll that CBS and the New York Times did about health care, about half of the people that were asked said they, as far as sacrifice goes, said they would be willing to pay as much
higher taxes,
$500 a year more, which is about $1.37 a day. Now,
the amazing thing, though, is that they wouldn't have to pay anything more. If we did away with private health care, you know, health insurance companies, and just had Medicare for all, we could insure, you know, with the money we're spending right now on health insurance, we could insure everybody in the country.
Well, the thing that gets me, I mean, my particular situation is, as I'm disabled, I have just I don't even think you could call it health care. I don't know any of these people who would willingly trade places with me, yet they seem to think, well, that's good enough for him, you know.
Yeah.
Let him bop along, and, you know, if he falls through the cracks, well, that's life.
I know, and that's the difference between viewing America as a collection of communities, and as at the national level as a giant community, and viewing America as a place where there's a whole bunch of individuals who are all looking out for their own self-interest, and if they can get, you know, a leg up on somebody else, and that person, if they have to step on their head to get on the way up, that's okay. You know, that's the American way. And I just don't think that that's the American way. I think that
a telling point is the average two-year-old, when given a command or a suggestion, says, I don't want to, and you can't make me. I think in 08 we're going to give the government back to the grown-ups. The two-year-olds have run it into the ground.
Yeah. Although, you know, it's interesting. There have been studies done on children, on young children, and although no is, you know, one of their most common words, typically because they've heard it so often because parents are trying to protect them, you know, no, don't touch the stove with your hand.
Yeah, I didn't mean to insult the two-year-olds.
No, no, but what's... There you go. But what's really interesting about that, Scott, is that when you look at some of those studies that are done, kids are more likely to share than they are to withhold.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, community is in our DNA. It's part of us. It's who we are as human beings. And you know, the studies show it. So.
And a child shall lead them.
Indeed. Indeed. Well said. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. I think I hear the music there. Yeah, that's it. We got to wrap up the show. Thanks for being with us this week. I'm heading home tomorrow. Looking forward to getting back to Portland, Oregon. And I'll be poking around the conference here for the rest of the day today and tomorrow. Maybe we'll come up with some interesting stories to tell you on Monday. Should be a great day. So I look forward to seeing you then. And until then, remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.